It's Monday morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Ricky Kidd was convicted of murder in 1996 on inconsistent and false testimony and without any forensic evidence tying him to the crime. In 2008, another man confessed to doing the crime with two other guys. Today, 5 years later, Ricky Kidd, who is still behind bars, and Dan Gotthaus, an investigator on Ricky's case, will talk with host Melvin Merritt. At the end of the show, for the 420 Drug War News, now some music before we launch into our show.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you. Oh yeah, oh my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you gonna need to stand by you. No matter how much money you got.
Good morning. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1 on your dial. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and on the phone with us this morning is Mr. Ricky Lamont Kidd, and in the studio we have the investigator, Dan Gotthaus, and I would like to say welcome to the show, Mr. Gotthaus and Ricky Kidd.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, and I just want to read a little bit from your bio, and it says that Ricky Lamont Kidd was born in 1974 in Kansas City, Missouri, to a loving mother, Vicki Kidd. Ricky was the youngest of two children, his sister Nikki being a few years older. They grew up as a close family and in close setting where moral values, principles, respect was the order of the day. Despite Ricky's father not being around, his mother created a nurturing home environment necessary for the proper growth. However, Ricky turned 12 years old and things took a turn, creating traumatic change in his life. The kid, who was well-mannered on track, began to make poor decisions. And Mr. Ricky Kidd, could you pick it up from that point?
Absolutely, I can, Melvin. When I was 12 years old, my mother had began dealing with an addiction. Again, as stated, my father was never around. My sister went and stayed with other relatives, and just, I feel, being emotionally unstable, I began the process of making poor choices, giving in to peer pressure, hanging around the wrong crowds, which subsequently landed me in prison. I was out there hustling. That's what they would call it, selling illegal narcotics, really trying to find my way. The further I got from the foundation that I actually grew up in, the further it's almost like getting in the ocean. And the longer I stayed, the farther the drift ended up taking me. And it ended up dropping me off on an island of incarceration. And here I am now in prison for a crime that I didn't commit.
So this was kind of like the beginning, because you wasn't a drug user per se.
No, sir.
And, And what were you doing as it related to the drugs?
Well, my thing was, like any kid, just wanted some money. And so I was introduced with a way of this is how you can get some money for yourself, little kid. And so I began to participate in those type of activities. But I didn't grow up in a gang. I didn't have a gang of friends that I actually ran with. I wasn't off into violence or anything, that type of lifestyle. I wasn't on corners and blocks and all of that. I would just find individuals who would smoke and then make them kind of like my private customers and get some side money. But Aside from that, I still did go to church. Aside from that, I still did attend family events. You know, it was kind of like a double life in a sense, because I still was attached to a lot of the things that I was brought up in. But as far as my ways and means of getting money, that's how I was trying to take the shortcut instead of going the right route. A lot of people would tell me, I remember one time, Melvin, that one of my customers had said, she had looked over and she said, "Ricky, why are you doing this?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "You're so smart." She said, "You just don't seem like this lifestyle is for you. You could do anything." And I paused. It was an awkward silence. She was sitting in the car. As I thought about it, she was right. Of course, I didn't want to admit it at that time, and so I joked, "Get out of my car." And we laughed and whatnot. But it was only later in my life, actually in prison, that I began to reflect back on everything that was instilled in me and the poor choices that I made, that landed me in prison for a crime I didn't commit.
Speaking of prison, what prison is that? I believe that they alluded to that in our opening.
I'm at Southeast Correctional Center.
Okay. So what landed you there?
The pathway was set with poor choices, associates, hanging around the wrong people. And actually, the more people would tell me things like, "I'm in the wrong life," and "Ricky, there's more for you," and it seems like this doesn't fit you, I had a girlfriend, Monica, and her family had stayed in Overland Park, and they was like almost like the Cosby family. And so I was trying to re-gravitate my way, or try to pull myself back to, this proper structure, the right environment that where I can continue to grow on the path that I started on. That worked on one hand, but on the right hand, my past had came to bite me. Friends who I used to associate with came in town, committed a murder, and when names came up, my name came up as an associate, as a previous associate of them, and when they started trying to piece it together as far as who was actually responsible, I feel that the math was it was a bad math equation in my mind.
Mr. Kidd, just for the sake of the anonymity of those that that are associated in your life, let's keep the names out, okay?
That's fine.
Uh-huh. So tell us a little bit more about your particular case, because I understand that you are incarcerated for something that you did not do.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little backdrop of that.
I could start, and of course I was locked up in 1996. I was convicted in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting, writing people, anybody who would listen, sending them key facts of my case for many, many years. Dan Grosshouse, who's in studio with you now, had took an interest in my case. I believe in after 2000, maybe 2002 or something like that. And his thing was, listen, my system is I work to prove you guilty. And so you don't go in with pre-judgment or pre-thoughts of trying to support one's cry for innocence. It was to let's really see. And so my feet was put to the fire. The facts began to be uncovered. We went to the Midwest Innocence Project, I believe in 2007. They came on board.
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
Along with other attorneys, and we began to prepare briefs and documents to go inside the courthouse and approve my facts. So in 2009, I received the evidentiary hearing. In the Western District Court, a lot of great information came out that clearly painted the picture of my innocence. But I began to run into the technicalities of law. My judge then would make comments like I had poor representation. He acknowledged that. He acknowledged on the record that this case was a shame. But at the end of the day, the law was real tricky, and the law didn't match with what he felt or what could have been done for me as far as relief. And so, unfortunately, I was denied in the Western District Court.
I want to direct my questions to Mr. Grothaus. What sparked your interest in this particular case, Mr. Grothaus?
One of the things that sparked my interest was, frankly, Ricky's persistence in claiming his innocence, and always my understanding in this field that it is certainly very possible for the wrong to be convicted for wrongful convictions. It's the system itself is, I wouldn't say riddled with human error, but I'd say the system is riddled with humans, and humans make mistakes. I think that was the case here. I told Ricky it's true. I said, Ricky, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend some time on your case, and I'm going to try and prove you're guilty and then move on. And if I can't prove that you're guilty, then I'm going to try and prove that you're innocent. And I started out with about five or six witnesses I wanted to talk to and became convinced that you weren't there at the crime. And then I went from there.
That's interesting. And so in your investigation, what did you find?
Well, in the simplest of terms, all of the witnesses to this crime saw three people enter a house. There was a very brutal and senseless homicide of two people in the house. This was back in February of 1996. And again, in simple terms, Ricky and another fellow were convicted. So without going into great detail about what I came up with, I certainly came up with alternate suspects, and I certainly came up with the fact that there was three people that committed this crime. Two were convicted, and I was convinced that Ricky was not there and not a part of this crime.
So one of the things that I've heard out of this particular case is that a couple of individuals have stepped forward and said that Mr. Kidd was not the individual that committed this particular crime.
We have good alibi witnesses. We have people knowledgeable of the crime who have came forward and said that Ricky was not a part of this crime. To my satisfaction, we have enough evidence to indicate that Ricky is innocent. I'm not the judge.
Sure. So have they brought this case back into court to look at the evidence? And
well, Ricky's right. It went to federal court, and he was denied relief on issues that I can't understand, not being a lawyer, and I'm not going to really try to understand them. Ricky's probably studied the law much more than I have.
Absolutely.
The tricky issues, I guess, is probably as good a way for a layman to describe him as anything. And, you know, there are lawyers still looking for the avenues that Ricky can pursue and get another attempt to prove his innocence.
So, Mr. Kidd.
Yes, sir.
At this point in your case, where is it now in terms of bringing it back into the courtroom and presenting the evidence that you guys have at this time?
Limbo, really, in short terms, is really in limbo. We're not really sure. Melvin, after we left the Western District Court, the judge, again, he issued a verbiage and an opinion that was on one hand favorable, but on the other hand it was unfortunate. We then appealed that to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the most conservative, restrictive circuits in the country, and they acknowledged my facts on record, and on record, unfortunately, had to deny me according to the technicalities of law. There was a newspaper article that was printed last year that highlighted, had I been in any other state, Colorado, Nebraska, or whatnot, this I probably would be in studio having this conversation with you. It's just that our circuit had viewed the way the facts was presented and developed as not being considered new evidence. They acknowledge the facts that points to my innocence, but under this narrow interpretation of what's considered new, and the law says actual innocence has to be new, unfortunately, I wasn't granted relief. We then went to the United States Supreme Court, somewhat optimistic, but they receive over 5,000 cases every session. They only could take on so many. I simply didn't make the cut. And so to answer your question, Melvin, we are trying to figure it out, exactly where do we go. So the executive branch, the judicial branch, those are the only two ways people get out of prison. And so either the judicial branch has to find a way to be able to give me a day in court, find a way to get around the trickiness of law, and grant me relief, or maybe some type of executive level action maybe to eventually come into play. So
how long have you been incarcerated?
17 long years.
Remember that you're in tune to Jaws of Justice, KKFI 90.1 on your dial, and I'm your host, Melvin Merritt. And on the phone, we're talking to Mr. Ricky Lamont Kidd, and he is incarcerated as he talks on the phone. And in the studio with us is Mr. Dan Grothouse, and that is the investigator in Ricky's case. And I'm going to redirect my question to Mr. Grothouse again. Is what are some of the other things that has come out of this investigation as what he had tied in to where you're at in this sticky part of this fine line of the law?
First of all, let me clarify. I'm a private investigator that was working on Ricky's defense. I'm not the investigator not the police investigator in the case itself. Some of the things that I'll say I worked with attorneys when I was doing this investigation. Some of the things that we developed. I'm trying to think of what we can easily talk about. We think that this might have been a case of misidentification. That certainly, is part of the issue. I think I'd rather just stay with the fact that there were three perpetrators. Two were convicted, and we have evidence that Ricky was not there.
So in other words, the prosecutors are convinced that Mr. Kidd is guilty of this particular crime. Would that be fair to say?
You'd have to ask them, because sometimes I'm not sure how convinced prosecutors are when they prosecute cases. I'd like to think they were convinced, but sometimes I'll look at the same facts and come away with a different take.
Depending on how you're looking at the case.
Certainly.
Yeah. Mr. Kidd, so what are you working on at this point? I know you mentioned about some of the things that you're trying to get presented back into the court as it relates to the evidence that you guys have come up with. And so what are you working on at this point?
Right now, as far as my job, aside from the investigator, Dan, and attorneys, is really just trying to get the case campaign going. I have a Freaky Kid initiative that has been launched on my behalf. We have a website set up, if I can mention it.
Sure.
FreakyKid.com, where a lot of the information can be reviewed. But Melvin, I discovered in this nightmare that it's a bigger issue than just about me. Some of the problems that we have that lead to wrongful convictions is perjury, false eyewitness identification, prosecution misconduct. And so we got to begin, and those are some of the leading reasons, according to the First National Registry of Exonerations. that leads to these type of cases. And so we don't just want to begin to report these matters after they happen, but begin to have discussions where we can identify ways to prevent them from happening in the first place. Professor Samuel Gross of University of Michigan, Northwest University, has put out some amazing studies about wrongful convictions and how more pervasive, how more prevalent they are in our society now. I do think that the more we realize that, or the more we believe that it's not a problem, the more we are inclined as a society not to do anything about it. And so my team, other than trying to get back in the court, is really just trying to get the word out about injustice, my injustice as well, and so that changes can be made.
That kind of leads me right into my next question, because you made mention that, you know, you want to bring some light to this injustice. And what are your plans? Because I really feel like you will be released. And what are your plans after you are released?
great question to me. It's like the individual who's lost somebody to a drunk driving accident or to breast cancer or to AIDS or maybe lupus. It's a passion of mine now. And so one of the things that I want to do when I'm exonerated is start a non-for-profit organization and involve myself in helping other people prove their innocence. Or, you know, injustice is tricky itself, because it's not just people who are innocent. Some people are overcharged, where it's a Class D felony, which is 5 years, and they slid in a Class A, which gave them life. That's a big difference. So Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once stated that a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Mm.
And so I've signed up for that notion, and I believe that I'm going to commit a significant part of my life now, not just when I get out, because I'm doing it now. I help guys in here every day, dealing with their situations, leading them in the right way, giving them information that I've compiled, resource packets, people they can contact or whatnot to maybe try to get some help. Chris Gardner had wrote a book, Start Today, Start Where You Are. And after reading that book, it made me, it's not a question of what do I do when I get out, but what can I do right now that leads to, or that can be continued once I get out. So,
Melvin, I'd like to add something to what Ricky said a little bit ago, and I'd like to address the cynicism that I'm sure is out there, who people who don't want to listen to somebody who's an inmate in state prison tell them about the injustices in our criminal justice system. My background is journalism. I was an investigative reporter before I got into this business 25 years ago. I've been doing criminal defense work ever since. Started in Texas, and then I came back up here where I grew up. And I can tell you that there is a lot of injustice. There's a lot of wrongful convictions. I'm reluctant to say that it's systemic, but I am not reluctant to say that it is not uncommon. You can't continue to have a series of exonerations and continue to call each of them aberrations. There is a problem with the system that refuses to acknowledge that mistakes are sometimes made. And I think any system that claims to be perfect is going to continue to make mistakes until they acknowledge that mistakes sometimes will be made, and we need to find a way to to correct the system and to address the way that these mistakes are made. And obviously, to address the results of mistaken convictions.
One of my biggest thoughts is that, you know, with the track record of finding people that are innocent that's incarcerated, why won't they look at cases like Mr. Kidd's that have presented some evidence that would show that he's innocent? And why won't they take another look, seeing that they have a track record of people that have been found innocent and was he released?
You know, that's a good question for the prosecutors, you know, of the country, the prosecutors of the state, the Attorney General's office. That's a question for them to answer. What I have seen is their insistence on maintaining the status quo and protecting the status quo. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the driving force behind their reluctance to acknowledge that a mistake might have been made.
Mm. Mr. Kidd, could you give your website again in case someone might be that's interested in looking your case up?
Yes, absolutely. It is www.freerickykidd.com. And they can go out there if they choose so to view more information. We have online petitions and all that type of stuff out there. It's definitely interactive where you could get case updates and learn different things and whatnot about what's going on with the case. So
you have done a lot of research in your case, and I can hear you talking about the books that you've read. And so you're definitely educating yourself as it relates to your case. I commend you, even though that you have the time to do all of this, you know, but the facts are the facts. And so, you know, I really pray you that you would definitely be exonerated, which I know you will. And I want to give Mr. Dan Grosshauser, could you give us the information on if in case they wanted to contact you?
Sure. My office number is 816-361-9191.
Okay. So that's the end of our broadcast. And up next is the 420 Drug War News. And so now the drug news.
We hope you enjoy today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out our page on the KKFI website, www.kkfi.org. If you want to contact or help Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Keith Brownhill. We thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder with Ramona Africa, the sole adult survivor of the 1985 police bombing of MOVE. Eugene Perrier, writer of the editor of Asada Secure, and Emilio Fusteno, farm workers and activists on the coalition of Immokalee Workers Fair Farm Food Project. Up next is Counterspin, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and on Eco Radio KC, Smog KC Style tonight at 6 p.m.